some newer people here.
How many here would consider themselves to be in that category, a newer, not so familiar with Bhagavad Gita? And you got one that's like this. Okay. Bhagavad Gita. I'd like to discuss one verse from Bhagavad Gita, and in the course of discussing this one verse of Bhagavad Gita, to kind of cover like the landscape of Bhagavad Gita. When we took off in Seattle, there's all these beautiful mountain peaks, and you come over the eastern part, it's all flat plain, and then into Denver, mountains and plain right next to each other. So the landscape of Bhagavad Gita. The verse that I'd like to discuss from Bhagavad Gita is the last verse of chapter 6. Yoginam api sarvesham madgatein antaratmanam shadhavan bhajate yomam sameyukta uttama mataha. In case you don't know Sanskrit, but the translation is, Krishna's describing here in a series of verses that precede this, Krishna's described, I'll paraphrase, that there are a number of elevating principles of life that Krishna has mentioned to this point in Bhagavad Gita. And now he's asserting that of all these elevating principles, best of all is the principle of yoga, or linking with the Supreme. There's austerity, there's charity, there's mercy, there's compassion, there's good works, sacrifice, so many things that are good. Well, all those good things, by all means, link with the Supreme. Become a yogi, in that sense, not just a yogi of meditator, but become a yogi. I'll read the verses. He's described that if you take up the path of yoga or linking with the Supreme, but supposing you don't finish it in this lifetime, what happens? Krishna gives two options. What happens if you don't finish, then because there's so much merit, kriti, that's been accrued from that practice of yoga, that after this lifetime, you'll go to the heavenly planetary region, long duration of life, enjoying heavenly pleasures, and after that, come again into this realm, this earthly realm, and basically continue where you left off. And taking birth in a pious family, or even better, a Brahmana family, a spiritually inclined family, or even better than that is, don't go to the heavenly realm and don't fall back down again, but take birth in a family of devotees. That's even better. Those who are just next life, continue right away practicing, continuing where you left off. The unsuccessful yogi, after many, many years of enjoyment on the planets of pious living entities, is born in a family of righteous people or into a family of rich aristocracy. Or, if after long practice of yoga, he takes his birth in a family of transcendentalists, for surely great in wisdom. Certainly such a birth is rare in this world. On taking such a birth, he revives the divine consciousness of his previous life, and he again tries to make further progress in order to achieve complete success, O son of Kuru. By virtue of the divine consciousness of his previous life, he automatically becomes attracted to the yogic principles, even without seeking them. Such an inquisitive transcendentalist stands always above the ritualistic principles of the scriptures. The ritualistic principles of the scriptures refers to, there's a section of the Vedas, it's called Karma Kanda section of the Vedas, a section of the Vedas that says, if you want wealth, do this. If you want beauty, do that. If you want good health, do this. Worship this way, perform this sacrifice to get these material wishes fulfilled. So the ritualistic, above the ritual, that ritualistic idea of attaining something worldly through some particular propitiation of some devata, is linking with the Supreme directly. So he says, and when the yogi engages himself with sincere endeavor in making further progress, being washed of all contaminations, then ultimately achieving perfection after many, many births of practice, he attains the Supreme goal. A yogi is greater than the ascetic, greater than the empiricist, and greater than the fruitive worker. Therefore, Arjuna, in all circumstances, be a yogi. And then this verse. Of all yogis, so he's, there's like a pyramid, and then there's the top of the pyramid. Things that are within the Vedic process that are beneficial, they're meant to gradually lead one to a higher stage of consciousness, and that culmination of consciousness is to link with the Supreme. Bring your consciousness in contact with the Supreme Consciousness. That's the progression. And of those who are striving for the Supreme Consciousness, this platform of yoga or linking with the Supreme, the indication is given that there's the topmost form, the uttama form of yoga is in this last verse. Shadhavan bhajate yomam same yukta uttama mataha. We'll go back down. In the beginning of Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna is speaking about morality and ethics. You know, some people don't consider what's to be done, what's not to be done. If it feels good, they do it. They just do it. But there are some persons that consider, before I just do something, what's going to be the consequence of that something? And so, could you sit still? Just sit still. Thank you. So, virtue rules above it feels good for some people. And so Arjuna is asking Krishna, what should I do? Here's this dilemma situation. I'm not sure what to do, what's right to be done. So Krishna then says, well, before you decide what's right to do, let's first talk about who you are. I'm paraphrasing, of course. So, Krishna then presents Sankhya Yoga. Sankhya means, literally it means to count. Like, over here there's the material elements, 24 in number. Over here, there's another component, that's the soul. Sankhya is to analyze the difference between matter and spirit. different types of matter, and distinct is spirit. So here's the soul. That's who you are. Now, again, before we talk about what is the ethical thing to do or the right thing to do, let's further talk about, so Krishna speaks about, how to keep that concept of the soul right here when you're doing things. Because it's one thing, as you know from being university students, to have an idea or an ideal, and then when the rubber hits the road, or when you're in real life circumstances, somehow it just disappears. How do you maintain this consciousness of my real identity while interacting in the complex circumstances of life? So then Krishna introduces another type of yoga, which is buddhi yoga, where intelligence directs the mind, and the mind directs the senses. And all of our activities is both physical, like gross physical, and the subtle internal psychological activities are directed by spiritual intelligence. And that's how you keep that consciousness, that conception of the self, right in the front while you're doing everything. And there's a key component in being able to keep that fixed, and that's detachment from the fruits of work. So Krishna introduces karma yoga. Karma yoga, you know the word karma. Karma is work and reactions to work. So good karma, bad karma. Karma yoga is to be detached from that whole field of action-reaction on the material plane and stay on the platform of the soul, even while doing work, by offering the fruits of work unto the Supreme. So there's a whole discussion about karma yoga and offering the fruits of your work unto the Supreme. And then there's this nice idea, very important idea, that you can stay in the position, back to the question Arjun had about being ethical, or those of you that are from India, you know this verse, karma nevadikara sema paleshu kadachana. So Krishna's teaching, perform your prescribed duty, stay waiting for the next stream. Do that which is your duty, whatever, for different persons, there are different duties according to the Vedic conception of things. We have our psychophysical nature, and we have different duties. But whatever that duty is, you perform your prescribed duty, but not with the entitlement to enjoying the fruits of that activity. Rather, the fruits of the activity are offered to the Supreme. You can stay fixed in the spiritual conception while moving through the complexities of life by that karma yoga principle, detached work. And after describing detached work, what's the consciousness that you then have developed? How is that best applied to fix your consciousness upon the Supreme? So Krishna presents, he discloses things about himself, transcendental reality of his own identity, just by disclosure. I am like this. And then continues again describing keeping that consciousness of him in focus while performing prescribed duty. So he says, perform your prescribed duty and always think of me. So your consciousness is upon the Supreme. You're doing what is your duty. You're doing proper, ethical, responsible work without attachment to it. And then when that consciousness becomes very strong, the form that it takes is meditation. Krishna then in the sixth chapter describes dhyan yoga. Dhyan. yoga is one of the stages of concentration of the mind. I won't bore you with too much technical stuff, but there's an eightfold yoga system. The final three of the eightfold yoga system is fixing the mind in dhyan, dharana, and samadhi, stages of concentration of the mind. And preceding that is what a lot of people know when they, you know, go to a yoga class. It's asanas. Yeah? Different seating postures. That's when you go to a yoga class. But that's just one out of eight that's described in this sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, then this one, dhyan, dharana, samadhi. So Krishna's introducing this, just simply concentrating the mind completely upon the personality of Godhead in a very structured way. He gives the details. And then we just read those summary verses where so many elevating activities that can be found in the world, can be found in the context of Vedic teachings. Austerity, charity, penance, ritualistic activities prescribed in the Vedas for uplifting the individual to a higher plane of existence, up to the heavenly region. All those things are described, but Krishna is saying here that above all of them, if they're performed properly, they'll lead one to this position of yoga. Now we're at the near the top of the pyramid, the yoga ladder, as it's sometimes called. So what's the purpose of a ladder? It's to get you to some position that's out of your reach otherwise. So you go one rung, another rung, and another rung. And that particular performer of yoga is characterized by the rung that they're on. But if they continue to progress, then they reach this culmination. The culmination is Shraddhavan Bhajate Yomam. Shraddha means faith. Shraddhavan, van means one who possesses. And Krishna's name is Bhagavan because he possesses bhagas. And bhagas are spiritual opulences. The opulences of God are unlimited. And they're in principle categories. Unlimited knowledge. Unlimited wealth. Someone in the world may be wealthy. Bill Gates, wealthy man. Maybe there's someone in the world that's more wealthy than Bill Gates. And somewhere else, and somewhere else, and somewhere else. But who is that person that can say they own everything? That person is Bhagavan. He's the possessor of, he has all wealth. And whatever wealth Bill Gates has, he can just take it from him. Because he gave it to him. And he can also take it from him. And knowledge, strength, beauty, renunciation, whatever opulences exist in their superlative degree, the repository, the sum total of all of them is whoever that person is, that's Bhagavan. So Shraddhavan is one who has faith. And what's faith? It's described also in Bhagavad Gita. Very nice definition. I'll go through it a little slowly. Faith is confidence that by achieving one thing, so many other beneficial things will at once be accomplished. Shraddha shraddhe vishvas kahi sudritha nishchaya krishne bhakti. Krishne is devotion unto Krishna. It's the faith of that's being described in this verse is if I can achieve love and devotion for the Supreme, every other thing that exists that's desirable will flow from that one thing. So somebody may not have faith in that, but they're going to have faith in something. In the 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna asks Krishna, what if they don't have faith in you? Do they have faith in something? And Krishna answers, yes. Because faith, essentially, faith is intrinsic to the soul. So if you don't have faith in the Supreme, you have faith in something. Because it's of the soul. And so then, according to the modes of nature, goodness, passion, ignorance, and combination, you get a whole variety of types of faith. But faith is of the soul. So faith in the Supreme is very special, unique, rare. It's at the top of the pyramid. It's the top of the yoga ladder. The other activities that are elevating in nature are by design to help bring us to that faith in the Supreme. And one who has Shraddhavan, one who has that faith, bhajate yomam. Bhajate, this word bhaj, B-H-A-J, not the English spelling, B-U-D-G-E, but bhaj is the root word of bhakti. Explained in the purport. And bhakti is specific. It's specific in two ways. It's specific in that it's applicable particularly for the Supreme. Let's just say we offer our respect to all living beings, even an ant or something we might consider insignificant. Respect should be given to all living entities in Vedic culture, but bhakti is specifically appropriate for the Supreme. We honor a person that's worthy of honor, and we offer bhakti unto the Supreme. That's the distinction. And the second special feature of this bhakti is that it means practical activity. The implication is it's not just, you know, a sentiment. Some persons think it's just a sentiment, but it's specifically not. By construct, the etymology of the word means practical activity. I mean explicitly bringing the senses in contact with sense objects and acting in relation to the sense objects, doing something in relation to the objects of the senses, to the instruments, the senses themselves. But the object of that senses contacting sense objects is serving the Supreme. Rishikesha Sevanam Bhaktir Uchite. Bhakti means trying to do practical activity, whatever it is, singing, cooking, thinking, working, doing, whatever you do, for the Supreme, for the satisfaction of the Supreme. Rishikena, Rishikesha. Rishikesha is the name of God. In Sanskrit language, Rishikesha means the master of the senses. The serving the master of the senses with the senses, Rishika. For his, out of love, as you would serve someone out of love. And serving someone out of love is not because you're going to get something back, but simply out of love. That's bhakti. One has achieved that. Shraddhavan bhajate yomam, Krishna says, same yukta uttama mataha. Mataha means it's my opinion. That's a very polite way of saying it's a fact. When we say it's my opinion, you know, it's just an opinion. When Krishna says it's his opinion, it's a polite way of saying it's a fact. In my opinion, this is the uttama form of yoga, which is the topmost form of any high-grade activity, any consciousness-elevating activity, is to come to the stage where you're linking your consciousness with the Supreme. So whether it's analytical, Sankhya yoga, whether it's intellectual, fixing, trying to fix one's intelligence upon the Supreme, Buddhi yoga, detached work, karma yoga, meditation, dhyana yoga, or any of the other yoga systems by different names. The culmination of them all is bhakti yoga, or taking that component that's inseparable from the soul, that's faith, and reposing that faith upon the Supreme. Of course, there's this little exercise of identifying, well, what's the Supreme? So the very next verse is a very wonderful verse. Krishna says, my dear Arjuna, I'm going to explain how to do that. It's a how-to promise. How to get to that position. So it's a series of things. It's what's the right conception of the Supreme, because in the spiritual marketplace, there's a whole bunch of different conceptions out there. Which one to identify? I was at the Redmond Library last night at a program, you know, where the home of Microsoft is. And there was a whole bunch of Microsoft techies at a program, and we had some lively discussions afterward about this particular point. In the spiritual marketplace, there's lots of ideas out there. What makes this idea any better than that idea? And so we had some lively discussion. So Krishna is going to give that explanation, and he keeps his word, how to understand that which is supreme, and how to direct in very clear ways the mind, how to direct the intelligence, how to direct the senses. You know, the external energy driven by the internal or spiritual energy to repose everything upon the Supreme. And that way, simultaneously attain self-realization and realization of the Supreme, as the indication that Krishna is giving, you know, going back to the very beginning of Bhagavad Gita, so that Arjuna, the person who is presenting this question, or ourselves, who Arjuna is asking this question on our behalf, how can we live our life in such a way that at the other end of it, the potential of this human form of life is realized? And we're doing the least amount of harm to other living entities and the most amount of benefit to other living entities. A nice objective. Now, how to do that? I'll make one other comment and stop. The context of Bhagavad Gita is Arjuna is Krishna's very dear friend. In fact, he explains within Bhagavad Gita, Arjun, I've appeared many times in this world, and you're always there with me, but you can't remember them. In the fourth chapter, where Krishna is saying that long, long ago, the same conversation that we're having here, I had with the sun god, Vivaswan, and Vivaswan then explained those teachings to his son, Manu, and Manu talked to his son, Ikshvaku, in this way, this knowledge has been passed on. Anyway, Arjuna is an eternal associate of Krishna. So there's no question of such a person of such quality, an eternal associate of Krishna, getting bewildered by deluded conceptions. So Krishna is specifically and purposefully placing Arjuna into this bewildered condition so that he can explain to him everything that we need to know Prabhupada gives this example that sometimes a mother whose son is married, she wants to pass on some message to her daughter-in-law, but she doesn't want to disturb the mind of the daughter-in-law, so she instructs her daughter in the presence of the daughter-in-law. And that way the daughter-in-law gets the message but doesn't feel like she's being, pressured or whatever. In the same way, Prabhupada is explaining, Krishna is instructing Arjuna for the purpose of instructing us. We're the daughter-in-law in this case. Krishna is instructing us by instructing Arjuna. So everything that Krishna is saying to Arjuna, and the other way around, everything that Arjuna is asking are the kinds of questions that a thoughtful person should be asking and will ask. And the answer that Krishna is giving is for us. Krishna is speaking Bhagavad Gita to us, although it's Arjuna Uvacha and Sri Bhagavan Uvacha. It's for us. This message of responding to the inquisitive spirit of a soul, a spark of life that's swimming in this ocean of material energy, not really sure and certain how this human, valuable human form of life is to be utilized. In presentations that I make, there's a picture I like a lot. There's a picture on this side is a painting of a baby still within the embryo, and over on this side is a big rock that shows a pile of bones, and in between is an opening, a gap, and that opening is life. In between birth and death, there's life. And there's a person sitting in a yoga posture with his back to you, looking at that opening called life, and what goes in that opening. We come into this world at a certain point in time, for sure we're going to leave, and what's supposed to go in that space? And a thoughtful person really wants to know. And the message of Bhagavad Gita is for persons who are inquiring within themselves and wherever they may place their inquiry, what goes in that space? Arjuna's question is, what's my duty? And Krishna's response is very step by step, very deep, very profound. I believe there's discussions in the Vedic society on Bhagavad Gita on a regular basis, and invite you all to take part. Any comments or questions from all of this? Yeah.
Just making sure that there's a microphone.
You can pass it around if people have questions. Anyone would like to ask something or discuss any of these points? She drank from it. She'll get it. Sweet will get it. Okay. Something's churning.
You said when you left something, if you didn't finish, then you will reborn to the finish.
So you begin the path of what I described as supposing yourself or somebody in this life, they begin going down the path of the message of Bhagavad Gita, of one, the Vedic system of one type or another. They begin some yoga, not just, the Hatha yoga, but, trying to reach the Supreme, connect with the Supreme. They somehow don't complete that. Then what happens? That's the discussion here.
So some, when they don't complete, then they will reborn and finish them.
Well, at least the opportunity is there. There's no guarantee they're going to finish it. They're given the opportunity. The guarantee is a human form of life and the opportunity. And then someone can say, no, thank you. Or worse. But the opportunity is there. The one way that Prabhupada has explained this is it's like a permanent bank account. So in this life, you put in 2%. In your next life, you start at 3%. Wherever you left off. But a material bank account isn't like that. In your next life, you don't have, 2%. You start at zero. Because it's in the realm of spirit, it's not, it doesn't deteriorate. Does it come by material cause, and it's not broken by material circumstance? Another important thing out of that is the Vedas, right here in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is recognizing there are heavenly planets. So the concept of heaven and hell and earth is certainly there within the Vedic picture of things. But the Vedic picture of things is beyond heaven there's another realm. And that other realm is Vaikuntha, or the kingdom of God. There's a very clear distinction between higher regions and the kingdom of God. And the destination of persons who are pious is they go to that heavenly region or higher realms. And those whose consciousness is fixed, like not 90%, 100% fixed upon the Supreme, they go to the kingdom of God, where there's no more of this birth and death. Anything else?
I guess I have a question.
Yes, sir.
I'm certainly a newcomer to this, and it's fascinating.
I hope there weren't too many Sanskrit words to, like, fuddle your mind here.
No, I'm fascinated by Sanskrit because it's
good.
An ancient, profound language.
Okay.
But what I would like to learn from you, perhaps, is a little bit of history.
Okay.
Of how these precious philosophies got started, and how long ago, and that sort of thing.
This one in particular?
Not necessarily that one, but perhaps as an example, yes.
Well, I'll be happy to address this one, and if there's more, then we'll go after this one. Krishna was present on this planet over 5,000 years ago. The picture of time of the Vedas is that time is cyclical. And within that cyclical time, there's seasons. We're just beginning a very beautiful season. I like spring. It's a very beautiful season. And after spring, we know what's going to come. And after summer, we know what's going to come. And after fall, we know what's going to come. So similarly, the Vedas describe cycles of ages of mankind, four in number, that cycle. And 5,000 years ago is when Krishna spoke this to Arjuna. In this conversation, he refers to a previous yuga, a previous age of mankind, when he spoke it previously. So this was extant at least 5,000 years ago. In the text itself, he describes where it was also spoken 2 million years ago. Let me just check those numbers. it's based upon the picture of this present. I'd have to explain things. Well, there's within these four cycles of ages, each of the four cycles lasts for 4,320,000 years. You're asking about time, so here we go. 1,000 of those, that's, add three zeros to 4,320,000. 1,000 of those equals one day of the Creator, Lord Brahma. And the night of Lord Brahma is an equal duration, and 100 of those years makes one creation. After that period of creation, there's annihilation. After that annihilation, there's a resting period of equal duration as the creation. After that resting period, another creation of 100 years times 1,000 times 2 times 4,320,000. Cyclical. So 5,000 years ago, Krishna spoke this message, Bhagavad Gita. Within the Bhagavad Gita, he is describing a time when he previously spoke it. Here we go. 120,400,000 years prior he spoke it. And of course, because God is eternal, and when this creation is annihilated, he still exists, and all knowledge comes from God. So it's eternal. And from time to time, that which is eternal is manifest by him in this world. And when he sees that that which was he manifested in this world becomes nashta, broken, lost, he'll reestablish it. As he's saying directly to Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita, because that chain of disciplic succession, there's a system where the person speaking, in this case Krishna, presents this knowledge to the sun god, and the sun god to his son Manu, and Manu to his son Itraku, and so on. When that unbroken line becomes broken, the knowledge, the potency becomes lost. It's like, there's a Con Ed plant or some energy electric production plant, and assuming they've paid their bill, the wires are connected, you connect a wire and you get electricity on the other end. But somewhere along the line, there may be the power plant, but if there's a break in the connection, there's no juice, although it looks like a wire. In a similar manner, scriptural knowledge is meant to be received in an unbroken chain of receiving it very carefully, passing it on very carefully, not changing anything, not adding anything, not deleting it, no editing allowed. Just receive it and transmit it as you received it. Appropriate for this time, place, circumstance, but unchanged message. Like a postal deliverer. Person writes the letter, seal the envelope, he just delivers, sir, this is for you. Oh, thank you. And it's from the author, unchanged. That's the responsibility of the disciplic succession. If that becomes broken, the potency, the spiritual potency, is lost. And so Krishna declares in Bhagavad Gita, from time to time, yada yada hi dharma shaglani, when there's discrepancy in dharma, I come myself and establish again, as he's done here with Bhagavad Gita. So 5,000 years ago, 120 million years ago, assuming in prior cycles of the yugas, sometime previously, and ultimately, directly from God. So it's just like, that's history, but the principle is that which is genuine religion is God-given, not man-made. There's certain things that are man-made and give it the label, this is God. The Vedic conception is directly descending from God, received by a person qualified to receive. God chooses someone to receive it, and then he passes it on to others. Abraham received and he passed it on to others, and so on. When there's a genuine qualified person, and then the future generation's responsibility is to preserve. Time will change, but essence should not change. That's the responsibility. Does that address your question?
I could carry it just a tiny bit further and ask how old is the oldest document of the Department of
Health? Okay. Previously, all of the Vedas were existing not in a written form, going now to the conception of time of the Vedas again. In previous ages, the memory of people was better, far better. And when this age begins, it's one of the features that's lost or deteriorated is memory. And so in order to preserve that which was previously present just by sound, it's written. And the writing personality, his name is Vyas, Veda Vyas, he compiled the Vedas, that's literally what his name means, divided the Vedas, there was one body of sound, of spiritual message, put it in writing and divided it into four and the subcategories of that, 5,000 years ago. The written form, 5,000 years ago. Prior, by sound. So it was existing in that form.
That document 5,000 years ago was written in Sanskrit.
Yes, it was. Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, we got the clarification of what question you wanted answered. Anyone else? Okay. Everybody's happy, or either that or hungry. Huh? Should we serve prasadam?
Yeah.